You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh.
Hi, my guest today is Rachel Bonds. Rachel is a wonderful playwright, and she was a great guest for me to have this week because Frankie and I have been going through it with the sleep deprivation right now with the baby. Got a little bit of the sleep regression going on for her, which means we're all not sleeping very well. And I was just a little bit underwater. We had such a great conversation, Rachel and I really needed it. But I can hear, listening back when I was editing, I can hear myself formulating questions a bit more slowly than usual. And the audio isn't perfect, but Rachel's voice comes through really strongly, really clearly. Her story is beautiful. And I'm really happy with the episode, even though it's not perfect in a lot of ways, in a lot of cosmetic ways. Rachel is a wonderful writer. She's a really thoughtful artist. And I wanted to continue the conversation a little bit that she started with her essay that she wrote for HowlRound.com last fall. It's called Working Like a Mother. It was published on September 11th, 2018. And it kind of went viral in the theater community online. So if you can go read it, please do. I will put the link in the show description. And I'm excited to share this conversation with you. I think Ceci is going to start sleeping better again soon, but keep your fingers crossed for us because she is the best, but even better when we're all well rested. I hope you enjoy the 130th episode of The Compass.
What is your definition of the dark side?
I guess that's the second part of the question is what does that mean to you?
Okay.
It means something different
to everyone.
But whenever I say it, people seem to have an idea
of
what I'm referencing.
Sure.
For a lot of people, it's like, you know, comparison.
Uh-huh.
Financial stuff. Or
yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, sweet girl.
Cecily is gonna let you know what it is.
Yeah. I think for me it's probably about, well, it's two things. Certainly comparison. There's that whole like keeping your eyes on your own paper, you know. Or like I used to work here in Astoria at a yoga studio, and like I got very, it was when I first moved to New York, and I was like watching all of my friends take off in various ways. And I still felt like, what am I? Am I an actor? Am I a writer? I don't know. I'm not really doing well at either right now. And I ended up working at this yoga studio, and I just took yoga every day and sometimes twice a day. I just was a place to be, I think, and I needed a community. But I think I really loved it because they were just like, stay on your own mat, you know, and that just like that idea of like staying in your own little square and just doing everything at your own pace.
Yeah. Of all the things to stumble into when you're trying to find your way, like having yoga be such a constant in your life.
Yeah, it was pretty great, and I so miss the fact that I used to do it, like I literally did it every day, and I think it was probably the healthiest I've ever been, probably during that, in a way. It was like my first few years in New York. So of course you're not healthy. You're like crazy. Okay. I was not sleeping a lot, but I was learning a lot. And I think the reason I kept coming back was just that idea of staying on your own mat and like just accepting that things are going to happen at their own pace. And usually exactly how you didn't expect. And that's still really hard to accept, you know? Yeah.
They always talk about too, that it's not about, you know, doing the pose.
Exactly.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
And looking a certain way.
Yeah.
And it's just the fact that you're breathing, mostly breathing for the entire hour or whatever it is.
Yeah. And I think that idea of it looking a certain way was a big deal for me to get over. Yeah, and I think in terms of career stuff, it's so hard to stay on your own mat. It just really, I mean, you just can't help but, you know, read the New York Times and just feel like, I wish that was me. It's just so hard not to do that. But I also think it's great to have people in your life who give you perspective. Like every time I feel kind of down about where I am or how slow I feel like I'm going or how unimportant I feel, whatever that means. Robbie's like, my husband is very good. Sweet girl. He's really good at pointing out, well, where were you 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And what are you doing now? This is actually what you're involved in right now. Such a big deal. You would have been so grateful to have this thing 2 years, you know, that's really helpful just to have other people who've seen you grow, have some outside perspective on where you are. So that the comparison thing is certainly a dark side. And I think for me, it's just about keeping my head down and writing. It's just like, just write. And I just always tell myself, like, well, if the work is good enough, it will just speak for itself, which is maybe really arrogant or stupid. I don't know, because I do think you have to do some, like, marketing of yourself, which is the stuff that I hate. And I don't spend a lot of energy doing it. I'm really not great at that stuff, especially since having a kid where it just feels like, am I really going to spend my energy schmoozing? Ugh. Can't think of anything I'd rather do less. But I always felt like, well, if the work is good, it doesn't matter. But that's not really true. Like the work is good, that's number one. But you also need to have relationships with people. And I like people. Like I like going to parties, you know. But it is taxing. And I don't have a lot of energy left over right now for that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And then the other dark side, I would say, is just that idea of like, what am I supposed to be doing? And for me, it's like every playwright I know writes for TV. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that is a financial, because it's just impossible to live as someone who writes for theater only. And I think at some point I will write for TV, but I don't right now, and I haven't been actively trying to. And so, there are days where I'm like, I suck. Like, why? I should be doing that. I should be doing it. And I'm just not. But I think it's because my heart's just not in it right now. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
When do you think that started? the thing where, like, playwrights were really
consistently
working in TV.
Yeah. I mean, I guess since the golden age of television started again, you know, like I guess with The Sopranos is when, you know, TV started getting really good again.
That was definitely my experience with the playwriting program at Juilliard.
Yeah.
All of those playwrights since I was there 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have been pursued.
And then I guess so much of it, is about technology and streaming, because now there's so many more shows out there. I mean, we're inundated with content. So there's just so many more opportunities for writers.
You want to say something about that?
Yeah.
So you said you like to tell yourself to keep your head down and just mm-hmm. keep writing. What is your the structure of your day-to-day life these days? What have you found that's productive for you? And
I think it's still a work in progress, but right now we have a sitter 3 days a week for 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And during those 4 hours, I go to an office. Robbie and I share an office. And if we both need to use it, one of us goes and works. And we're in a co-working space. So if one of us needs privacy in the office, the other one goes in the common area and you can work in there too. But
So your son is two?
He's two. That's he's right. A little over two now. Yeah. Yeah. So,
And your husband's in the arts as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Big time. Big time in the arts. Yeah. So I have about, because it takes me about 15 minutes to walk to the office and 15 minutes to walk home, I have about 3.5 hours to work 3 times a week, which is not a lot of time. But I do think I can be efficient when I need to be. But what it doesn't leave is a lot of time for letting your brain wander. And I think that I miss that. Just having I think if I had 6 hours, maybe I could just wander a little bit. Yeah. The 3.5 hour thing makes it feel a little more product oriented. And I'm I gotta bang out, I only have this amount of time. So yeah. I better write 10 pages or whatever it is.
You've had to change your process in that way.
Yeah. And I work more slowly. I work in more fragmented ways, but also my brain is drained sometimes. It's just taking care of a kid is so consuming, as you know. It's yeah, I mean, it just drains you. It's also, of course, really joyful, but it does drain your energy and your creative energy too. That's starting to shift more as he's older, but yeah, it's really hard to focus sometimes. You have to I definitely have to turn off the internet. I set a timer for 20 minutes where I'm allowed to respond to emails, and then I'm not allowed to look at email anymore. I just give myself those 20 minutes to do email, and then I'm okay, writing space. So you do have to make all these rules for you. Or at least I have to make rules for myself.
Otherwise,
for
time just disappears.
It disappears really fast. And some days I just feel too, writing just feels too hard. And I just stare at email instead and just read things on the internet, just because I was I think this is all I can face today. And I think that's okay. It doesn't feel great when I'm doing it. And of course I always feel guilty, but there is something to be said for some leisure time too, in terms of having a creative brain, I think.
How did you feel after you guys had your son? There's not much space allowed by society for recovery from that.
Yeah.
I guess people are kind of used to the idea, even though not many people get it, used to the idea of a maternity leave.
Yeah. But yeah.
As far as that mental toll.
The mental toll.
You,
yeah.
And not wanting to show any.
Because you don't want to seem weak.
No, and you don't want people to say, "Oh, I knew it. She can't."
Yeah,
do
she
this
can't do it.
She had a
exactly.
Kid. But you're also dealing with the reality of
sleep deprivation.
And Frankie and I are both dealing with sleep deprivation.
But also just emotional.
The way you think.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you feel you're not allowed to.
I know.
To deal with any
of
that.
As I was telling you, some days I can't even write. It's too much. I was I shouldn't say that because I'm going to appear to be a weak woman. Because it does, I always hesitate to talk about that because I don't want to not be considered as an equal to my male counterparts or my non-parent. I don't know. You know, it is like...
You don't get the same work done on another day. But.
Yes, it is. It's really hard to be seen as when you have your kid to... I think a lot of us feel like I can't show weakness. Whatever. But I think our idea of weakness is wrong. Yeah. And that's something that needs to shift. Yeah, because our brains are just doing double work now, because you're both thinking, taking care of yourself and your work, but also a whole other human being. That also goes for people who are like taking care of a family member, not even a child. You know, I've done that too. And it's just caretaking in any way.
Yeah, and those are things that you'd think that the theater would be even more understanding about.
Yeah.
As some like an empathetic group.
Yeah.
As people, I mean, think about humans.
Yeah, it's about humanity.
Yeah, about humanity. In a
I mean, it's
way.
Supposed to be.
But I feel like sometimes there can be such a kind of a scared atmosphere of like scarcity.
Yeah.
That people feel yes. like I can't even ask for that day off to go deal with this personal thing. I can't
yeah.
even do this because otherwise they'll get somebody else.
Yes.
When really, like, everybody deals with that stuff.
Yeah. It all just feels so dramatic. And I think because it all goes back to money, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of scarcity. So there's just not enough money for anyone. No one's making enough. Everyone's working really weird hours. I think that it all goes back to that. That sort of creates the feeling of scarcity.
Well, let's jump around a little
bit. Yeah.
So you said you started out as an actor and a
writer. Yeah, yeah.
And I saw that you went to Brown.
I went to Brown.
That was for undergrad?
Mm-hmm.
Did you move to New York right after that?
Uh-huh. Well, with no thought. I just was like, I guess this is what we do.
And where did you grow up?
Tennessee.
Okay.
Yeah, a little college town called Suwanee. And so Providence was like a great middle city for me to start living in a semi-urban environment.
Right.
I mean, I was on a college campus. And like that, you know, that area of Providence is very bougie. But I had never lived anywhere urban before, ever. So it was like it was a good sized city for me to start to feel what it was to live in anything remotely urban. And then to go to New York from there was good. I spent a semester living here when I was a junior. I just needed time away from, my dad passed away in the middle of sophomore year, and I like never got to go abroad because it all kind of just happened that year. And so I never did any of those things I was supposed to, you know, I just didn't get my act together to like do a semester abroad. So I just took time and went, did a program here at La Mama.
Oh, that's fun.
Like a very strange experimental solo performance program, but it allowed me to write and act. Because I was writing for myself. But the best thing about that program was just getting to live here and seeing stuff. We saw, like, part of the thing was that we all had an internship. And then, and I had an internship at Here Arts Center,
mm-hmm.
which was great.
I finally got to do a show there a couple years
ago.
Yeah,
it's such a cool place.
A little theater, but
yeah,
it was one of the first places I had seen a friend's show.
Yeah,
before I
it's
even
a great
in
place.
New York, and
yeah.
I was so excited when
yeah.
I got to do it.
And they have a puppetry program, which is also
yeah.
so cool.
Very
yeah,
cool.
So I had an internship there, and then we just saw things, and we saw a lot of. I mean, it was so cool that it was at La Mama because we saw like a lot of experimental stuff,
mm-hmm.
weird stuff in Bushwick, and then we would see like Carolina Change. So I just got exposed to a lot of things I wouldn't have otherwise. It was a great way to spend my like grief-stricken junior year of being totally paralyzed and not really knowing. I was like, I don't think I can be in school right now. It was just too hard to meet deadlines, and not that there weren't deadlines for this program, but it was different.
Yeah. Probably having something so different.
It was really helpful.
So.
Really helpful. Yeah. So I spent like a little bit of time living here, and I ended up staying that summer and doing the acting intensive at the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. It's just really funny to think about now that I did that, but I did, which was also great. And I met so many people there. So then when I moved here after graduation, it was like less intimidating for that reason. It was still awful. such a shock. And I had horrible insomnia that whole first year. I would stay awake. I was having really bad anxiety, like full blown panic attacks, but I didn't know that's what they were. Mm-hmm. And I would just stay up like in my room until 5 a.m. And then when the sun came up, I was like, okay, I can go to sleep now. It was all about anxiety. I think it was like the dark was freaking me out. I couldn't fall asleep when it was dark.
Were you writing much at that time?
Not really. A little bit. Yeah. I was starting to try to focus on it more. Because acting, I was like, I don't know if I should be doing this or not.
So how did that transition change?
Yeah.
When did you first start thinking of yourself as a playwright?
I spent that year when I first moved here not sleeping. I worked for Jim Carnahan Casting. I cried every day in the bathroom at the roundabout. But then I actually they took me under their wing and were really cool, but they like hazed me at first. Yeah, but I learned a lot for that job. I learned a lot. And then I would just like sleep between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. I would just sleep like 2 hours a night. So bad. And then that summer I applied to do the City Company intensive in Saratoga Springs. And I was like, this seems cool. I like experimental theater. Oh, baby. Yeah. So I went. And I got in, which I was like, this is a sign. So I went to Saratoga Springs. I met a ton of people, and I met a bunch of people who were in the directing program at Columbia, because Anne Bogart runs it, or did. I don't remember if she still does. Anyway, I met City Company. I met a lot of like wonderful people there, and people were doing devised theater. So I got just interested in that. And just from there, I just started kind of focusing more on my writing. Oh, little girl.
You're so close.
You're so close.
Let's give it a shot.
Good work.
So you were saying,
yeah.
When you were on that City Company training, was when you really started focusing on your
writing? Yeah, well, after I came back, I started working. I like did some projects up at Columbia with the directors up there. I just got a little more interested in devised theater, and that kind of led to me writing more. And I was always writing, but I was taking some classes here and there, but I didn't really know what I was doing. So I just would kind of like experiment and,
Were you writing still mostly for yourself?
Was at first, and then I was writing a lot of monologue plays, and then I started to shift into dialogue right around the time I met Robbie. I think I honestly think I was using that kind of writing to deal with my dad's death. And it was like I just needed to like write from the first person and like write out that experience. And then when I got a little bit of distance from it, I could like separate myself from the work and write about other people. So like a few years, I honestly think it was all about dealing with that loss. And then once I had a little distance from it, I could write for more characters than myself.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And then how did you go about finding your way after that? Has it been a lot of learning through experience?
Yeah, what did I do? There used to be this company, Voice and Vision, which was all about female writers, and I took a class with Lisa Damore there. That was really helpful. I developed a play in her class. And then I did another little workshop. I don't even remember the name of it. But Lindsay Furman, who is the literary manager at EST, mm-hmm. was leading this workshop with two other people just to like develop a script. And so I took that with her, and that relationship really helped. She was really encouraging of my writing. And I worked on a play in that class too. And just like having like a classroom environment, but it wasn't in a grad program. It was just like a little workshop, you know, it was like 8 weeks or something. Right. And just having that experience of being in a group and having to have a deadline and having a dramaturg. She was like, Lindsay served basically as my dramaturg. That just helped me keep going, I think. And she encouraged me. And I think I just needed somebody to say like, you should keep writing. And also Robbie was saying the same thing. He because I was still like, should I be acting? And he just said, listen, I think acting is where you will shrink and writing is where you will expand, which was what I was feeling. You know, I was like, I feel like I have to put myself in this weird box to perform. Or I feel like I'm pushing up against, like, I'm supposed to look a certain way if I'm going to play that part. You know, it just felt too confining to me. I also think I'm a person who really likes to be in control. And
don't we all?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, little girl.
You know, we're so close, but maybe I'll go give you to Bobby. Okay. Sorry, one second.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, my God, don't be sorry.
We tried.
Girlfriend.
She's here for the first time.
Heck yeah. I like seeing her little face.
Oh, she's
so sweet. She's got a good face.
That's such an interesting way that he put it.
Yeah. And
shrink versus
and
expand.
In my mind, it was like a very dramatic moment. And like the next day, I was like, goodbye, acting.
Well, that's what I was
hello, writing. Like in my memory, that's what it was. It was like this big turning point. Like that night, I was like, made the transition, and I'm sure it was much slower than that, but that made a big impact on me because I think it was what I was feeling but couldn't put into words.
Was there any sadness about letting that
yeah
identity
for sure? Yeah, definitely. But I also was noticing that when I was reading or hearing about my classmates from Brown, especially who were succeeding in the writing world, I was so jealous.
Interesting. So the people that you were comparing yourself to.
I just found that I was like, I'm so jealous. I'm so insanely jealous of them. So that was also interesting. It was. I mean, I was like, there was something that I longed for. And I think I wanted to be creating the worlds. And I had come to respect writers so much and like feel like really starry-eyed about them. And of course I had always been writing like since I was a kid, but I had never considered myself a writer, even though I took so many writing classes in college. It was like what I was focusing on really, but I still didn't consider myself a writer. And then after that, whatever that fateful night when he said that, I just kind of flipped. I just stopped trying to act at all. The last thing I did was a production of The Cherry Orchard at Columbia with one of the directors there, which was fun. But again, I was like, I don't really enjoy this that much anymore. And I love actors. Like, I love them and I love being in the room with them. And that's why rehearsal is so, it's just my favorite part. I mean, there's a high you get off of when you're like early in the flow of writing something new and you're really in it, and that you do just, it feels really, really good. But a lot of the time it just feels really, really hard. I mean, it's both. I think I just love rehearsal.
Yeah, you have those two extremes of like that part of the process.
Yeah, it's super, it's super lonely, but also
that part that's so communal.
That's that's me. I think I'm an introvert, but I also like parties.
You need both.
I do. Yeah. I don't know how much I get like a little bit into astrology, and it lines up. All of my signs and moons and suns and all that line up exactly with that.
Have you found any collaborators that you've been able to work with several times?
Yeah. Yeah. I am.
Like, oh, this clicks.
Yeah. So Mike Donahue and I work together. He's directed almost all of my plays. Let's see. Yeah. I mean, we work together over and over again because he's also just a very dear friend now. But he is a really good, he's just really good because he's very specific and the language that I write is very, the punctuation down to like how many H's are in the yeah, like it all needs to land because there's like an event in each little thing, and the events of the play are usually small and emotional and they could be missed. So he's just so good at pulling them out and lifting them up. He's also very, very good with actors. And I think I write plays for actors. I guess everyone writes plays for actors, but I feel like I
know what you mean, though.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm interested in, everyone has to be pretty emotionally vulnerable, but also very athletic with language. I think my plays demand a lot of people, and he is really kind to actors, and that's important to me. That doesn't mean he doesn't get tough when he needs to, but he leads with his heart, I think, and that feels right. I think that's why we're a good match. He's also, I mean, I say he leads with his heart, but he's also incredibly smart. he's got the brain and the heart. So we work together a lot. And then Annie Kaufman and I have worked together. We only did one play, but for some reason it feels like we've done a lot of work together. I guess because we did a workshop before we did the actual production, but I've just been trying to find another project to do with her because I loved that collaboration. She really gets like deep in the trenches with you in the rewriting, and I love that. Also, she's very specific, and her brain works at a pace that is difficult to keep up with. But I just trust her so deeply. Yeah. So those have been I mostly work with Mike, to be honest. Yeah. At least in the past few years. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like an artistic marriage of sorts. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has it with other writers too, but I really like working with him.
What are some of the things about like the way that new plays are developed in the US that you find really helpful as a writer, or maybe a little more frustrating? Like, there's this whole circuit of
development. Yeah. I mean, you can really get stuck in development hell where you just, I think readings are kind of the worst thing ever. They never are good. They never feel good.
Are they ever useful to you?
No. I mean, a workshop is really helpful. I find that so helpful when you're just in the room for however many hours, 29.
Like doing table work.
Doing table work and discussion, and I rewrite frantically the night, and then we bring in new pages the next day. I get so much work done during a workshop.
Right.
I find those so, so useful. I find readings they're like auditions. Mm-hmm. I mean, a reading is really about inviting industry people to come hear your play and decide whether they like it or not. You usually have like 4 or 5 hours of rehearsal, which for my plays, I think this is true of anyone's plays, but because the events are so small and emotional and they take a lot of work from the actors, and because they're like easily missed, it feels really hard to achieve the arc of the play in a 5-hour rehearsal. I think that's true. Most playwrights would say readings are deathly, but I think when I have had readings, they often people come and are like, nothing happened in that play. You know, because it was just so hard to achieve the events and pull them out and lift them in 4 hours of rehearsal. Because you're so worried about like who's at what music stand when.
In which stage direction.
Yeah. And it, and the whole thing is just such a, it's so process. I mean, it's so, sorry, it's so product oriented. It's about, and you almost end up, I think sometimes we cast the wrong people because they'll do well in a reading because they have like high energy. They can sell it because that's what people want, you know, but they're actually not right for the play. I don't know. I haven't had a reading in a long time, which is maybe good, but also feels like nobody knows that I write plays anymore. I used to have them all the time, and now I think, yeah, it's really slowed down since the kid. But they can be so detrimental, too. Mm-hmm. I've had one good reading, I think. And I even left being like, that went awesome. But I've only ever had one that I thought was good.
Yeah. No, it's just, it's interesting to me that you hear so many times about how theaters for new plays are only really interested if they're the first production.
Yeah.
Like the world premiere production.
Yes, yes. And that's really frustrating.
Which to me, it just doesn't seem that important.
I know.
If it's a play that you like, then I know. Please be the second production.
Yes, I know. It's probably going to be a better production, the second production, because the writer will just be more confident in the work. Yeah, it's really, that's really tough. I have so many plays that are just, you know, one-offs, because they're just not interesting to people anymore. They were already done once, so. And that's sad. It makes me sad that they lived briefly. Yeah, and they're plays I really liked. Like, the first project Mike and I did together is this play called The Wolf Twins, which we did at Studio Theater in D.C., which is, I love working there. It was one of my favorite working experiences I've ever had. I just really enjoyed working on the play. The cast just had this sort of magical chemistry, and it just died after that. Like, we did it. It went really well. It was well received. And then nothing ever happened. And that just makes me sad for the play, because I really liked that play. And that happens too much. I know, there is some, like, this, like, sparkly thing about having the world premiere.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
There's lots of things I want to talk about, but obviously one of the things when I emailed you was wanting to talk about being an artist and a parent.
Yeah.
Since it's something you've been going through the last couple of years, mm-hmm. Frankie and I are just embarking on it. And you wrote this essay that you published on HowlRound.com.
Yeah.
In September?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah. I remember it was the day I weaned Quinn officially, and then I published that article. I was like, this is interesting timing.
That is interesting.
Oof. Yeah.
And I hope everyone will go read it, but it, just to summarize, I guess, it was all about being a working playwright with a kid and the difficulties that that brought up and the choices it made you have to make. And, and also offering some
solutions. Yeah.
What made you put it down on paper?
Honestly, a few things. One of the, like, silly, shallow things is that I had been nominated for, I was a finalist for, was it a nomination or a final? I don't even remember what it was exactly, for a Steinberg Award for this play, Curve of Departure. I don't know if I was a finalist or I was just nominated. I can't remember. I was among the nominees. And in my head, I was like, I'm going to win. And so I started writing an acceptance speech in my head. Just like so horribly arrogant. And the amazing thing is that Molly Smith Metzler won it for this play, Cry It Out, which is about motherhood. And I haven't seen it either. Which is an amazing play and absolutely should have won that award. Yeah, she's awesome. And it's such an important play. And like, I'm so happy that she won that and that that play won that award. But in my mind, I was like, I'm going to win. And so I just started like writing this speech in my head because I was just thinking like, if I win this, like, what will I use that money for? And I was like, well, childcare. And I don't know. I just started thinking like, what will I say? Because I don't want to just be like, thanks. I had this sort of like speech going on in my head. And then, of course, I did not win, which is fine. But I just started thinking like, I'm still thinking about what I was going to say. And so I was like, maybe I should just say it in find another way to say it. I don't have to have won an award and give a speech in front of a bunch of people, but I could just put it out there. Yeah, which of course I didn't consider. So I just had it. It just was kind of on my mind and I just kept thinking about it. And also the experience I had on the West Coast left me pretty gutted. And I think I was looking for a way to deal with that. So I just went on HowlRounds. I think I was talking to Jen Silverman, who's a good friend of mine, about, I don't know, we were just hanging out one night and I don't know, lamenting some of the, how hard it is to travel for work. And I think I was like, I feel like I should write something about this. And she's like, you should. So I just went on HowlRounds site and just like pitched them the idea. And they said, we want you to do it. So I was like, okay, now I have to do it. and they said, but we want you to frame the essay with solutions. Like we want you to have frame the thing as though here are my solutions to this problem. So I was like, okay, great. And then I wrote a really rough draft of just my solutions. And then I talked to some other parent artists to sort of hear from them what they thought. I mean, a lot of them lined up with mine, but some, they also suggested things I hadn't thought of. I took all those thoughts that were sort of bubbling around in my head after having this really hard experience on the West Coast doing world premiere and this speech I never got to give. And then just a kind of a list of like, here's what we would ask for if we could from other parents. And then just sent them a draft. And we went back and forth on it. It was, the essay originally was much longer and like a little, I would say, argue a little darker and a little angrier. And I really had to edit it down for space, honestly. I didn't realize at the time, but it was really scary to write it because I was like, oh, maybe as we were, the day we were publishing it, I was like, oh no, this is actually terrifying. I never name any theater because that's not really the point. The point is that the problems are systemic, but I was worried that people were going to never hire me again. That hasn't happened though. I haven't heard from anybody except for Jason Egan, who I almost only said good things about Ars Nova because they have only been so great to me. But he really reached out right away and said, thank you for writing this. And we've been really working on these issues here. Yeah. So I don't know. I want to write more about it all. But maybe, I don't know, I want to write some things from hearing from fathers too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so much more to say about all of it. I also would maybe want to do another essay in September, a year after, and just see if anything's changed for people.
Yeah.
Because I heard from so many strangers just reaching out. I mean, almost all mothers, almost. I heard from one father, but a couple fathers, but
kind of went viral, at least in the community.
Yeah.
From what it seemed like.
I don't have a sense because I'm so bad at social media. I deleted my Facebook account because I just always makes me feel bad whenever I go on again because I have trouble keeping my eyes on my own paper. But then I was like, I should probably rejoin so I can post this because I don't know how else to share it. I don't have that many Instagram followers. So.
No, but it's a terrible, you talk about a lot of different issues in the essay. The fact that I know for Frankie and I, we probably waited several years longer than we would have liked to have kids just because we were so worried about
how you would be perceived,
or how opportunities we wouldn't be able to take.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we wouldn't be breaking even, mm-hmm. or we wouldn't,
I know,
be able to travel.
Or, yeah.
You know, we're a very, not that we have great finances, but we're very financially responsible.
Yes.
So we didn't want to have a child in an
unresponsible
way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I always get extremely excited when I see artist families.
Me too.
Have kids.
Yeah. Are figuring it out.
Older than I am.
And yeah.
I can kind of look up to them.
And yeah.
Like, look, they did it.
They did it. I know. Yeah. And there are those people.
Yeah.
But there aren't enough of them to. It's hard. I feel like sometimes we hide our kids because mm-hmm. we don't want people to see them as a weakness of some kind, which is so fucked up.
I don't remember who you said this in the essay. Someone said children are a fact.
Yeah, children are a fact. It was in they did this profile of Alana Brownstein in American Theater Magazine, and she said that, I believe, or Kristen. I can't remember who said it, but it's in that profile. Yeah.
And I'm still such a new mom that we'll see. And right now I'm taking a break from auditioning mm-hmm. anyway, so I'm doing a different kind of job. But
yeah, for real. Yeah.
I grew up home educated. And so we just went everywhere with my mom.
Right.
That was a big part of it. And she was an entrepreneur and she didn't have a tradition. She was a French teacher too. She didn't have a traditional job.
Wow.
But we were just always coloring in the back of the room,
yep.
whatever meeting she was in, or reading in the corner.
Right. So that is
your... in the car, which evidently isn't allowed now.
Yeah, right. Oh my God, I know. That's insane.
So it doesn't seem that strange to me, but it really just isn't something that the modern world accepts.
No. Well, the modern world hates women.
Yeah.
In general. I mean, that's a horrible generalization, but they do. And
the basis of it all, really.
Yeah, I think so. I mean... they want you to have your baby. They don't want you to ever have an abortion, but then they don't want to have to deal with you and your baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the general, it's a horrible generalization, but I do think it stems from misogyny. And children are related to women. I mean, I feel so ashamed, for not understanding what parents I've worked with were going through at the time. When we did the first production of my play, 5 Mile Lake, Daniela Topol directed, and she was in Orange County with me for 5 weeks while I think her daughter was maybe just two then, and she was just, she came out for maybe a week or something, but she spent so much time away from her family to do that job. And then I remember when her daughter did come, there wasn't a space for her in the artist housing, and they put a pack and play in the bathroom, which is just so awful. I mean, just not good for sleep for anyone, and sleep is such an important part of mental health. At the time I was like, oh, it's so great that she's coming out, but I had no idea what sacrifices she was making just to show up to work. And I'm very ashamed that I wasn't aware of that stuff. But it's until you are living it, you just can't imagine.
Yeah.
You just can't imagine.
I think it's not to the full extent.
Yeah.
Until you're in that.
But I wish I had just understood more. And I don't know. I feel like in my 20s, I would just see women with strollers in my neighborhood, and something about it annoyed me. You know, I was like, move out of the way. I was like, you know what I mean? And now I'm just like, that was misogyny at work in me. You know, I feel like I've internalized so much. Yeah. What about women with strollers was annoying to me, or what about them was in my way? I mean, because now I am the woman with the stroller. And I'm so aware of myself feeling like I'm in the way sometimes, you know, of people. I mean, it's a busy city and people move quickly, but I don't know. I've become really aware of how much misogyny I have swallowed over the years, you know.
You can't help it to a certain extent.
Yeah.
It just seeps in.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about the books that we have, I feel like Robbie and I buy Quinn books every week, because it's we both love books so much. We have so many books for him. He also loves books, but it's the thing that I never feel bad buying. Yeah. So we just have so many of them, but so few female characters, so few female protagonists. Most of his books are about animals, but they're always he.
Interesting.
And I was just thinking, I'm sure people have said this before, but we grew up learning from all the stories that we tell you and the books, learning to identify with male characters.
Yeah.
We learn to empathize with men from age zero, but boys don't have as much of a chance to empathize with female characters.
You see that playing out in what TV shows, what movies are sold to what audiences, and women are expected to.
Yeah.
Watch everything, and men, there's no reason for them to watch something without a female protagonist.
Yeah, we keep making a concerted effort to change the pronouns to she in a lot of the books. We have this whole construction site book about all the construction site vehicles saying goodnight, and Robbie makes them all female. Of course, this doesn't even address the non-binary, transgender characters. We don't, I keep thinking how, because we have all these books that are this is a boy, this is a girl, and I was like, we gotta get some more books, because it's so much more complicated than this. But and I'm not doing a good job of explaining that, but I just was thinking the other day about how all the stories I read growing up were mostly about boys, and so I learned to empathize with them from day one. This is a tangent. I don't know how I started talking about this, but I don't know.
So are there any resources that you found really helpful as a parent?
So I haven't fully taken advantage of them yet, though I'm kind of starting to be an ambassador for the Parent Artist Advocacy League, PAL. And they are pulling together that they have this handbook about how to support parent artists and pregnant artists. They have a whole lot of written resources that they're creating.
Are they based in New York City?
They are based out of Philly.
Okay.
But they're kind of everywhere. My friend Caro is an ambassador. She's in Chicago. They have people everywhere. A lot of New York, Chicago, Philly. And they're an amazing resource for anybody who's working in the performing arts and parenting. I would say particularly for actors, but for everyone, stage managers, designers, everyone. But started by an actor, so she's really sensitive to what it means to travel for work when you have children and all of that. So they're an amazing resource. And then what else? I was saying I went to a lot of breastfeeding support groups. In Greenpoint, there's a place called Wild Was Mama, and they have breastfeeding support group Wednesdays and Fridays. And I went every week for many weeks, because we had a very hard time for a long time. And then it worked itself out. But man, breastfeeding is, I would say, the most complicated thing I've ever done. And just for so many reasons. I don't think I was prepared for how much you have to give yourself over to it.
It's a huge
commitment. It is a huge commitment, more than I ever realized. And I got a little bit dogmatic about it and was like super anxious about bottles and super anxious about formula. And all of that was so much about postpartum anxiety, I think. But also just about the fear of doing something wrong, which I think was just like the whole, I mean, I think that never stops. We're always right. Just going to be like, am I doing this wrong? Because I don't know what I'm doing.
Even though most things, there is no right or wrong.
Yeah, something but in the middle. I was really anxious. I was also really sleep deprived. And, you know, I was freaked out about him getting too into the bottle and not into breastfeeding. And then of course, when I went back to work, like, we hadn't done enough bottle feeding and he hated the bottle. And that was even more horrible because I was like, I can't leave him. He right. won't take a bottle. It was like so much of that stress of my first job back was about feeling like I had failed my husband by not letting him do enough bottle feeding. I had failed our kid by not preparing him for me to go back to work. But I'd also, it was like
so
mega failure. It's so complicated and tiring. And you're just so physically tied to this person that then if you're away from them, there are physical consequences. And that is crazy.
That was so
And it's such a visceral experience. Like, we only weaned just a little bit ago. And then weaning is a whole, it's such a roller coaster. It is truly the most complicated thing I've ever done, I think.
I finally, like, a couple months after she was born, went to see a play by myself. And
oh, man.
The feeling of
being
walking through the city.
Yeah.
I was walking. I think I went down to New York Theater Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
Which was like far.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
It wasn't just like walking around the neighborhood and knowing I could get back in 10 minutes.
No, you were in a whole other borough.
But to be walking through the city just as one person without her strapped to me or something, which is the way I've done it for the past 13 years in New York City.
Yeah.
It just suddenly felt so bizarre.
Yeah. You feel like you left your wallet at home or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like wonderful, but then also that feeling of like, oh, if the MTA does something, if I don't get back in the right time, there are these consequences.
Yeah, it's so scary.
Yeah. Very bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the working and breastfeeding is really there. Adrienne Alice Hansel, who is the literary manager at Studio Theater, was like incredibly supportive of me. She has two children. She sent me this book called Work, Pump, Repeat. And that is a really great book for anyone who's dealing with pumping while working. And I found that really helpful. What else?
How have you been feeling since, how are you feeling now since putting out that essay in September? Do you feel like any of your approaches to these conversations with employers have changed or just your
attitudes? I've consciously tried to talk about my kid more, and when people are asking me about, can you come out for this, can you come out for that, I always say I have to figure out childcare. I'm trying to just mention childcare always so that it doesn't become this thing that I'm ashamed of. Just becomes normal every day, like the same as somebody saying, like, I have to rearrange my other meeting. Like, it just to have it be just a normal detail of everyone's lives. So I've consciously tried to do that.
That's great.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going out to Chicago in a few weeks just to do some casting for a play that'll be in the fall. And they were so awesome when they were asking me to come out. They're like, we read your essay. Do you want to bring your kid? We'll figure out, like, let's figure out your housing if you want to bring him. And just the fact that they offered. I, of course, was like, no, thank you. I would like to come by myself. because we were able to figure that out with our schedules. But the fact that they offered was so huge.
That's great.
Was so huge. And that it was part of the conversation at all. Was so huge. That meant so much to me. And just hearing from other women who've written me has been, you know, just makes you feel less alone. Yeah. Yeah. Also, I enjoy helping people. And I think in this business, you spend so much time working on yourself and thinking about yourself and how your career is doing and how, you know, it can be so, you can have such tunnel vision and it can be so selfish, the whole thing. And so it's been really nice to feel like I'm doing a little bit of something for other people.
I was really amazed when, like, leading up to when Ceci was born and right after, like, how many friends, but also, like, acquaintances in the theater reached out to me.
Yeah.
Other moms, other parents to be like, if you need anything.
Yeah.
And these are people that, you know, I might see once a year or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just sending me really intimate, lovely emails.
Yeah.
Saying,
because it really is this, like, weird cult that you really join. Sweet. My friend Sarah Gantcher, who's a playwright, also, she's when I was pregnant, she was like, this kid, she's like, you have the baby, and it's basically like you join a cult, and they just break you down to zero, and then they build you back up as a parent. And that is exactly the experience. But you do kind of join this cult that you can't possibly understand until you're really in
That's how people describe grad school.
It's similar, yeah. They just break you down. Yeah.
Well, there's two questions I normally ask at the end, unless there's anything I skipped that you really wanted to touch on. I know we've been all over the place and
had some interruptions. I'll just give a shout out to Robbie, my husband, for being such a, I mean, we're just talking a lot about women and mothering, and that is a huge subject, but I feel like I've been able to figure out working because he is so, he is as invested in my work as I am. And that's so huge. Yeah, I feel like the saddest part of us becoming parents is that we don't get to, like, see each other's work as much. Right. Like, I used to go to every single one of his shows, and now it's like few and far between, and that's sad. But he's very invested in me, in me, but in my work too, and that's so important. And he's also, you know, spends so much time doing childcare as well. So
lovely.
Yeah, I'll just give him a shout out.
I love it. So the first of these two questions is, when you are in that dark place or feeling uninspired or just kind of low, are there any concrete things that you go back to again and again?
Like, I think reading is reading.
Just reading in
general. Reading. Fiction. Something? I think just reading something in another genre is really helpful. I usually go to fiction. Yeah. But also, I don't know, Robbie gave me the David Sedaris book, the latest David Sedaris book. And, like, that's been really, he's, I don't so know. I love him. And I only just started the newest book, but it's also, it's so funny, but also dealing with suicide and dark stuff. And, but I find reading, it re-inspires me. Just reading other people, usually just fiction. I don't want to read plays. I don't like that. I feel like I'll start to try to write that play. It's better for me to read. Yeah. Fiction usually. Yeah. And then I would say just doing something physical. I like to run. I don't get to do it as much anymore because it's just tough to like, am I going to work today or am I going to exercise? And I usually have to choose one. But and I usually choose work. But I do think physical, just like shaking yourself up physically is usually opens something. It opens some kind of hole to the other world. I do think it does.
And then finally, have you seen anything recently of any art form that you want to recommend?
Ooh, that's good. I don't see nearly enough. Okay, I saw the Oklahoma that was at St. Anne's.
We missed it. We're going,
but it'll Frankie's be on Broadway.
Is getting us tickets for Christmas to the Broadway.
Okay, version. That was just one of the best things I've ever seen. I just thought it was so. I mean, that it is such a weird show, and I didn't remember that. And then
I watched the movie when I was a kid. Yeah, and I remember it being strange.
It's strange, and it's really, I'd say, an important piece of art right now. And it's just, it's so good, and everyone in it is so good, and all the design is so good. I loved it. I loved that. And then I saw Usual Girls, that Roundabout Underground.
That's so Ming Pfeiffer. So
yeah,
I didn't
and
get a chance to try to see it.
I thought that was just excellent. Good. And I'm still thinking about it. Speaking of misogyny that you internalize, it really does a good job of showing
life.
How early that starts, and how I think the last line of the play is like, it never fucking stops. Oh. And I mean especially if you're a parent to a girl, what a boy too, just it was really well done, and I'm thinking about it a lot still. I hope it'll have another life.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope to see you. Well, Rachel, thank you.
Thank you.
This was wonderful.
Yay.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brandon Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.